This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the second week of February, and this week, the Attorney General told the president to cool it a little bit. The president has been on a vengeance tour of sorts, removing officials like Alexander Vindman and Gordon Sondland, who testified in the impeachment trial. He also rescinded two nominations he'd already sent to the Senate. Elaine McCusker, a financial official at the Pentagon, who had resisted Trump's unlawful efforts to withhold congressionally appropriated Ukraine aid, and Jesse Liu, the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, who had failed to prosecute Trump's enemies. Trump also tweeted he was outraged at the harsh sentencing recommendation for his one-time associate Roger Stone. Prosecutors recommended 7 to 9 years for Stone, who's been convicted of witness intimidation and lying to Congress. That recommendation was later reduced after Attorney General Bill Barr's intervention. Trump attacked the judge overseeing the Stone case, intimated that he might pardon Stone, and demanded to know why the people who've wronged him haven't been prosecuted. Attorney General Bill Barr then sat for an interview with ABC News in which he said the president's tweets, along with criticisms from Congress and elsewhere, make it, quote, impossible for him to do his job. But Barr also described a level of intervention in cases of concern to the president that would have made Republican observers blanch in the Obama administration. Barr acknowledged and defended his own intervention to push for a lighter sentence for Stone, saying he intended to do that even before the president complained. Later in today's show, we're going to take a look at developments in the Democratic presidential primary, where Bernie Sanders narrowly won the New Hampshire primary and has taken a lead in national polling, and where Mike Bloomberg is also experiencing a surge. And we'll talk with an expert on political television advertising about how and when it works. But now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So, Rich, it was outrageous for Attorney General Loretta Lynch to speak with former President Bill Clinton on airport tarmac for several minutes at the time that the Department of Justice was considering whether to bring charges against Hillary Clinton related to her email server. Was it acceptable for Bill Barr to weigh in personally to soften a sentencing recommendation for at least one associate of Donald Trump? I'd note that in addition to the Stone issue, the NBC News reported that senior officials of the Justice Department intervened to soften a recommendation also for Michael Flynn.
Yeah, I mean, he's running the Justice Department, and there was, by all accounts, not just Barr, there was reporting about this prior to Barr's interview where he talked about it. There was a dispute between the supervisor of this line prosecutor and the line prosecutors about what the sentencing recommendation should be, and he took it up to Bill Barr, and he runs the Justice Department. And the recommendation that came out on Monday was fully within the guidelines, but still, I think, by any reasonable standard, excessive, that Roger Stone would go to jail for 7 to 9 years for lying to Congress, and then this threat to this associate of his that his associate didn't take very seriously. Roger Stone said he was going to kill the associate and kidnap his dog. I think usually he would kill the dog first and then kidnap the associate and then maybe kill him later. But obviously, you know, Stone is a fantasist living in a bizarre, his own bizarre version of Watergate and The Godfather. So this does not strike me as particularly inappropriate. What's inappropriate is the president, who creates this haze of illegitimacy over the entire process by popping off on it.
Wait, can we stay with Barr for 1 second, and then we can talk about the president's comments? Because I take your point about the sentence. I also thought that the recommended sentence seemed excessive when I first read about it in the press. But I mean, I would say two things about that. One is that the sentencing guidelines may, in a lot of cases, produce calculations that lead to sentences that look excessive. And yet it is the policy of the Justice Department that you're supposed to ask for the guideline sentence, except when you have this sort of extraordinary approval from the top to do otherwise. So it's, you know, there are lots of defendants out there who might deserve that sort of consideration. They're not getting it. This in this instance, the reason this got up to the Attorney General is because it's a politically sensitive case, because Roger Stone is close to the president. And when the president cares, that's when that intervention ends up happening, which strikes me as inappropriate. And then the second thing is the system already has a way of dealing with situations where the guideline sentence is inappropriate, which is to say the judge does not have to impose the guideline sentence. And so the president was reacting here, and Bill Barr was reacting here before the judge acted. When I talked with Ken White about this on All the President's Lawyers on Wednesday, Ken thought that it was very unlikely that Amy Berman Jackson would have imposed the 7 to 9 year sentence.
Right.
So it's, you know, procedurally, I totally get that that sentence seemed too high, that there are reasons to say you shouldn't have got it, but there are excellent procedural reasons, it seems to me, why the president's friends shouldn't get this kind of intervention from the attorney general when a regular defendant would not.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Obviously, it's politically sensitive, so it's getting more attention because of that. But what is the just recommendation? It seems to me that that's the foundational question. And this recommendation, again, it's technically strictly within the guidelines, but would strike most people as excessive and unjust. And Barr, if we believe him, didn't think they were going forward with it. No surprise that they did, and then wanted to rectify it. And then Trump tweeted, and then it creates this conflict for him. Does he appear to be kowtowing to the president and do what he was intending to do otherwise, or does he back off and not push for the result that he thought he had ordered just because the president has tweeted?
Liz, what do you make of that?
I mean, the entire thing, like Rich said, has this film of illegitimacy over it, and it's been dreadfully protracted. I worry that in some kind of perverse way, Trump even enjoys it because it keeps the attention on him and his drama, and he can score all of these minor victories when things seem to work out in his favor. And I'm inclined to just mostly ignore it for that reason. I mean, I understand it's important that, you know, for fairness and equality reasons, Roger Stone faced the justice system for having committed crimes. But at the same time, the entire thing is just so demoralizing and unsavory. It doesn't seem worth the time to me.
Well, but I mean, isn't the rule of law important here? Isn't it important that we have, you know, a justice system that acts without regard for whether somebody is the president's friend?
No. Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, he should face the justice system and should be, you know, convicted and properly sentenced. I think what I object to more is, you know, when we have bigger things going on, and I'm thinking here of the primaries and the run up to the 2020 election, we give Trump so much time to kind of relitigate everything he wants to relitigate and claim these victories for himself on and off throughout these sort of melodramas that he likes to unfold on TV. I resist that precisely almost because he seems to lean into it so much with this inadvised popping off. I mean, Barr himself said Trump should stop tweeting about it, that it makes his job hard. So you have to imagine that there's a reason Trump is doing that, and that's because Trump must discern some benefit in it. So if he's having a good time, I'm not. And so for that reason, I think I tend to tap out a bit.
So there are sort of two ways to take Bill Barr's complaint here that the president is making his job difficult. One is what the attorney general should be saying, which is that the president shouldn't involve himself in specific cases like this, that it's important to have this arm's length relationship with the Department of Justice in order to have the good administration of the rule of law. The other way to take it, that I think a lot of Democrats are taking it, is that Bill Barr is like, look, I am here covering for you. You are making it more difficult for me to do that when you put all this public pressure on me. Now, the flip side of that is that if Bill Barr is really in there trying to corruptly cover for the president, then it was a pretty bad screw up to have a miscommunication, have the wrong sentence recommendation sent down on this, such that then he had to revise that. If Bill Barr was a good henchman, he would have seen to it that the sentence recommendation came down as he wanted it to on the first try. But what do you make of this public dispute between Barr and the president? Because I think a lot of Democrats look at this conspiratorially and say, this is Barr trying to achieve public distance from the president so that he can take actions on behalf of the president without so much appearance that he's doing the president's bidding. It doesn't really strike me as Trump's style to authorize Barr to do that. The Trump's message has been that he is in charge here. And in fact, he tweeted again after Bill Barr spoke saying, well, I haven't told Bill Barr what to do with individual cases, but I could, and I have right. that power. So I don't, what do you think this is a genuine dispute between Barr and Trump?
I do. Look, I have a lot of respect for Bill Barr, so I come at it from a different perspective than all Democrats do. But I think he is sincere. And it's not just that it was awkward in this case, and you know how you view what he did. Obviously, it goes to the discussion we're having a moment ago. But just any presidential pronouncement on a pending investigation or case creates this sense there might be an undue command influence. And I think Barr was making that broader point and showing how it affected him on this particular Stone matter. But again, at the end of the day, as Ken White pointed out to you, the judge is going to do what the judge wants to do. These guidelines used to be considered binding. They are no longer. So the stakes of what the Justice Department recommendation is much lower than it would have been a while ago.
Liz, somewhat to your points, I think the Democratic candidates have been a little bit at a loss about how exactly to react to this, how much focus to put both on what Donald Trump is up to in general and then specifically on these issues of rule of law. We have seen Elizabeth Warren out there touting that she's going to have some formal effort to investigate the actions of the Trump administration, which has been controversial because, you know, on the one hand, the president has surrounded himself with criminals, quite a number of whom have been charged with and convicted of crimes. It seems like there's stuff to look at there. But on the other hand, I think people worry about the idea of a president somewhat in the vein of what Donald Trump has been doing here, trying to direct what the actions of the Department of Justice are going to be with regard to specific people and specific investigations.
Yeah. And I think that's a reasonable concern, especially as you say, we're concerned with the rule of law. I think the other anxiety it triggers in people is that we're going to end up being in this permanent cycle of presidents elect vowing to and then trying to instigate investigations into their predecessors, you know, of different parties especially. So Donald Trump was very emphatic that he was going to have Hillary Clinton investigated and put away. That was the genesis of the whole lock her up thing. And so, you know, vowing to investigate Trump, while there may be and does appear to be plenty to look into there, I think put some Democrats in that mind that we're going to trigger this unending sort of vengeance cycle of presidents-elect coming into office and then trying to pressure the Department of Justice into looking into their predecessors. I think that would be a real problem just from the point of view of like maintaining governmental legitimacy. It begins to look sort of suspect if every single president you have investigates the one that came before them for crimes. But, you know, then again, maybe presidents and people involved in politics shouldn't be doing so many crimes.
Rich, I think some of Trump's frustration here, and that's getting borne out in some of the personnel moves he's made, and we're seeing this in some of the press reporting, that it's not so much just about associates of his getting convicted of things and facing harsh sentences or potentially harsh sentences. It's also about the lack of exactly those investigations that Liz was talking about him wanting, that, you know, the Justice Department reopened an investigation around Hillary Clinton in some perfunctory way, but didn't charge anybody, didn't charge James Comey. On Friday, we learned the Justice Department will not prosecute former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, who there had been some question about whether he would be charged for lying to federal investigators. That's the former Deputy Director of the FBI, who the president absolutely loathed. And so what do you make of the president's apparent desire to redouble on some of that stuff? They've created this line for Rudy Giuliani to provide information about Ukraine into the Department of Justice through the U.S. attorney in Pittsburgh for whatever reason. It seems like the president really is determined in some way to use the Department of Justice as his own personal vengeance vehicle. And it makes me wonder if he'll have more success with that in a second term.
Ideally, that's what it would be for him. There's no doubt about it. Barr was very forthright about that, just that he, AG shouldn't take such directions and that he wouldn't take such directions. There is an equity issue, though, that I do think is legitimate with Roger Stone. I mean, people lie to Congress all the time. And if you happen to lie to Congress and get caught up in a special counsel investigation, then you're really going to get nailed to the wall. And I have no use for Roger Stone. He lied. He's clearly guilty of these offenses. I mean, the offenses are in text messages, so there's no question about it. But that's where I think Trump and his allies do have some cause for complaint.
But then how do we stop people from lying to Congress if there's no penalty? If you basically say, well, usually people don't get punished for this, so you shouldn't punish people for it. If the rule was really that you didn't get punished for it at all, then there would be no reason to tell Congress the truth. And the testimony that Roger Stone gave was about a matter of public concern. It wasn't some incidental lie. He was trying to cover up the nature of the interactions between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks in the 2016 campaign. So these weren't trivial lies.
There's no question that he's guilty. It's just that this wouldn't have happened to him if there hadn't have been the whole Russia collusion investigation and the Russia, the obsession with Russia. So don't lie to Congress because you can get prosecuted. But there are plenty of people who have done what Stone did has done or worse, who are walking free men. I think that's a legitimate point.
I mean, Paul Manafort probably wouldn't have got sent to prison for tax evasion if he hadn't gotten caught up in the 2016 campaign either. But that doesn't seem like a good argument against the Manafort sentences.
He evaded
a very large amount of taxes.
I'm just saying there's an equity issue, and this has it's happened in other investigations too. The Iran-Contra investigation, you know, you had a deceptive testimony to Congress leading to massive charging of people for lying to Congress, and this is just it's inherent to the
that was also about
process.
A matter of great public concern.
It is. I'm just telling you, if you get caught up in a special counsel investigation,
yes,
you're going to get nailed to the wall, and if you don't, you're not, and there is an inequity in that.
Liz, do you? Does that worry you at all?
I mean, yeah, it's a concern. I think it's been a running concern during the entire Trump administration, and I think that it's a reasonable one. You know, I wish it were different. And I think, you know, again, not to beat a dead horse here, you know, the best chance we have at turning around not only the administration, but the political culture Trump has encouraged to bloom in Washington, D.C. is to win 2020.
Yeah, that's fine, but I don't think the primary reason that you prosecute these people is because of electoral effects, or at least that shouldn't be the primary reason. And it's not that it's, you know, this is the primary way that you stop damage to public institutions or that sort of thing. It's that you prosecute these people because that is how you deter crimes. You need some sort of penalty on some people who do things like lie to Congress so that there's a reason not to lie to Congress.
No, I fully agree. And we don't disagree on whether or not to prosecute them or even whether or not they should be sentenced, you know, after being convicted. I agree on that and perhaps would even agree to harsher sentences than you might. It's more of an issue of whether or not we stoke this attention-craving narrative building tendency Trump has that seems to have been provoked by this trial. I think he senses that he can use it to elicit sort of sympathy, indignation, and outrage from his base. And maybe there's no way around that. Maybe the simple fact of honoring the rule of law and prosecuting people who have committed crimes is simply going to do that. That bespeaks a really big problem politically, I think. But perhaps it is also the case that by giving it less air, you know, or at least giving it less intensity, I suppose. And I think about my role as like a liberal media person, right? As a left person in the media, I'm very cognizant of how that lands with people in Trump's base and how it can be exploited, my commentary on these issues, to activate them. So I've had that on my mind as well.
Rich, before we go to break, one other thing I want to ask about is some of these personnel moves at the White House. There were these nominations that the president pulled back, basically fearing that people he had nominated to various sub-cabinet positions were not as loyal as he wanted, especially Jesse Liu, who had been overseeing some of these prosecutions at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. She was supposed to get a senior job in the Treasury Department, which she now will not. The president also brought this guy, Johnny McEntee, who's a former college football player who used to be his personal aide. He's now going to run the White House office that oversees personnel. Hope Hicks is also coming back to the White House. Feels like the president getting the band back together, basically trying to focus on who's most loyal to him. When the White House has gone through phases like this in the past, you know, with the firing of James Comey being one of the big examples, these episodes, I feel like, have not ended well for the president politically. The chaos that has ensued in terms of personnel turnover appears to have been negative for his poll numbers, and it also has prevented him from professionalizing the operation in certain ways that he's needed to get policies made. So what do you make of that as a Republican watching this? If the White House is turning inward and really trying to have these loyalty tests, what is that going to mean about the way Trump governs for the next 9 months before the election?
That's probably not good. It's just a certain amount of chaos, obviously, is priced into the system. And after this whole impeachment episode, he is apparently more paranoid about people around him than ever. And I mean, it is a real issue because it's really hard for him to find loyalists who view the world the same way he does, because the way he views the world is very idiosyncratic. There are just not many of these people out there that are suitable for government. And a lot of people around him have contempt for him and have no loyalty to him because they know in part he has no loyalty to them. And that's just a weakness of his governing style that's not going to go away.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times to talk about the Democratic presidential primary campaign. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. The New Hampshire primary was this week, and Bernie Sanders was the winner with just shy of 26% of the vote. Pete Buttigieg was 1.3 points behind him with 24, and Amy Klobuchar got a surprising 20. Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden, who once looked like strong contenders in New Hampshire, both finished in single digits. The candidates have now decamped for Nevada and South Carolina, which will vote later this month. I should note, as I have previously, that my husband is a professional Democratic political fundraiser, and his business this cycle has included raising money to elect Pete Buttigieg. Liz, Bernie Sanders has now won the popular vote in the first two nominating contests. He looks like the favorite to win it again in Nevada. He's moved into a lead in the national polling. On the other hand, he hasn't won these contests by much. 25.7% is the lowest vote share ever for a winning candidate in the New Hampshire primary in either party. Was that good enough in a state where he got 60% of the vote 4 years ago?
Well, you know, 4 years ago, he was running against one person, and now he's running against an entire field, and each person in it represents at least a slightly different flavor of Democrat. So I think it's sort of predictable that, you know, Sanders wasn't going to kill it in New Hampshire, just absolutely murder it and win by 20 points the way he did last time. Right. I mean, that's difficult to do, especially because this primary field has resisted winnowing. You know, so is it good? Yes. Is it good enough for the time being? Yes. I think that at least the establishment Democratic Party feels like it's good enough because they have started to prepare oppo on Sanders. Last night, it was revealed that Emily's List Super PAC, for instance, is working on a negative ad comparing Trump to Bernie in order to damage Bernie. So, you know, I think that the people who know they need to be worried if Sanders wins are worried.
What did you make of this result, Rich?
I mean, a win is a win, but it was a real narrow win. And none of these candidates have shown much ability to widen out. Buttigieg, if you look at the New Hampshire results, somewhat broad-based among this white electorate. According to one exit poll, college-educated, non-college-educated, basically Buttigieg did equally well. But can he win non-white voters? Klobuchar seemed, in New Hampshire terms, even more wine-track than Buttigieg. You know, her coalition was skewed college-educated. And Bernie turned out his people, and he has them. And that's really important. It's better than the alternative. But can he widen out from that? Now, the good news for Bernie is that he you can see scenarios where he doesn't need to widen out. If the center-left continues to be fractured between Buttigieg and Klobuchar, and then with Bloomberg's entry in Super Tuesday fracturing it more, you get the scenario where Bernie can get some sort of delegate lead, and because it's proportional representation, it's really hard to take away someone's delegate lead once there's any sort of lead, and then you take that into the convention and dare them to try to take it away from you. That seems the most likely Sanders scenario at the moment.
Yeah, Liz, I mean, to Rich's point and to your point about the field resisting winnowing, the 538 Democratic primary forecast model, last I looked earlier on Friday, had a 37% chance that nobody will have a majority of pledged delegates going into the convention. And that number just keeps going up and up and up as we get these close results. And so I think that a key question for Bernie is what he needs going into a convention in order to actually get the nomination. Obviously, if he has a majority of pledged delegates, he'll get it. I think if he has very close to a majority of pledged delegates, if he has, you know, 46, 47%, something like that, with the closest challenger way behind him, I think it is very likely that he will get the nomination. But it's looking to me like it's possible that we will not only have no one with a majority, we might have no one with a claim to have close to a majority. And so I'm wondering what you think a convention looks like if Bernie is going in with the most delegates, but say it's only, you know, 37% of the delegates.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is what no one wants to see. I know the Sanders campaign would prefer a clear majority of delegates. I think the second best option would be a slightly less clear majority of delegates. But nobody, the Sanders camp or the establishment, I would have to think, wants to see a brokered convention where some kind of deal has to be worked out. I do think that there are people inside the Democratic, the institutional Democratic Party, who feel like at this point trying to get a brokered convention is their best bet, because at that point they would have maybe a little bit more power where it comes to keeping Sanders from getting the nomination. But I feel like, I think, you know, all people of reasonably goodwill recognize that that could be extraordinarily divisive, right? I think Sanders has recently said as much himself. A brokered convention would be a real morale crusher. If Sanders came in with close to a majority of delegates and then some sort of deal had to be worked out and he wound up not taking the nomination, you have to think that a very good number of Sanders supporters in his very active base would simply not vote in the general, which could doom a Democrat against Trump. I think you've seen some good evidence in polling that Bernie's voters are more likely to do that than voters of the other candidates in the field. So I think that's something that people should keep in mind. But the good news is, I think it's too early to start worrying about that, right? We're only two primaries in. There are, I think, 98% of delegates or something like that left on the table. So there's plenty of time for the field to winnow and for the race to get a little bit clearer.
But this mirrors a conversation that Republicans were having in 2016 as they were heading toward a convention and trying to game out, was there a way to stop Donald Trump from walking away with the nomination? And if the Republicans had the nominating rules that Democrats have, Donald Trump would not have gone into that convention with anything close to a majority of delegates. It would have played very differently. Maybe Donald Trump wouldn't have been the nominee.
Yeah, I think, you know, one experience from Republicans in 2016 is that if you really kind of put it frontally to voters, there's someone who's ahead, and your choice is just nominating that person who's ahead, or a brokered convention that's probably going to tilt them towards the candidate who's ahead, just because of what Liz was talking about, the likely effects of a brokered convention. It's just not going to be very good for your party, likely. And I just, it's just, even if Bernie is, you know, 1% delegates ahead of the next finisher, just it's gonna be really hard, I think, just because of the small D Democratic legitimacy around having more votes than the other person. It's gonna be hard to take it away from him. And if they do take it away from him, it is gonna be a hellacious mess.
I think certainly a brokered convention, no matter how it ends up, is very messy. But I think there is less resistance within the party to the idea of going to one than either of you are putting forward. And I think Elizabeth Warren has already started her messaging that is focused on the idea of a brokered convention. This is why she is putting out all these talking points about being the unifying candidate within the Democratic Party, by which she I think means that she is acceptable to the broadest set of people in the party. The idea would that their theory is that Sanders supporters would think, well, at least we got a left progressive candidate, and supporters of more moderate candidates would think, well, at least she's more within the style and the approach of the establishment party, and at least she is literally a Democrat, unlike Bernie Sanders. I don't really buy this argument. I think if Warren were that appealing as a unity candidate, she'd be doing better than fourth place in the national polls. But
yes.
Liz, it does feel like she is that explicitly moved into that messaging. And I think while it is early now, when we come out of Super Tuesday, about 40% of the delegates will have already been allocated. And if the results are close like the ones so far, it could look very difficult for anyone, including Bernie Sanders, to run up big enough totals to get to a delegate majority with the remaining of the contest. So it feels like we're in for a four-month period in that scenario where all of the campaigns will have to be running with an eye toward trying to win at a brokered convention.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that they already have on their radars. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is moving into that messaging. She's doing quite a few things that signal that she's trying to sort of get the establishment wing of the party to agree that she'd be the unity candidate. I think that the farce in her reasoning is that she could grab the Bernie base. That might have been true a few months ago. But after these back and forths that she's had with Bernie, I have seen at least, and this is anecdotal, I haven't done any polling on it, but, you know, among Bernie people, a significant disenchantment with Warren after the discussion, let's say, of Bernie having said that a woman might have difficulty running for president, Warren trying to exploit that in the debate to I guess make Sanders look like a sexist or something along those lines. I think that extremely aggravated Bernie's base. And then in her post-New Hampshire speech, she took time to sort of castigate people who are interested in, you know, political gains for progressives, but are rude about it. And I think that the Sanders base took that also as a comment on them and an insult to them. So she's going to have to run against Bernie if she wants his people and make the case that she is a better fit. But the problem is that running against Bernie tends to aggravate Bernie's people. You should probably be focusing more on pulling than pushing. And so I don't see a unity candidate in this field. And maybe that is evidence that there probably will have to be some kind of brokered convention. I would emphasize that if Bernie's base especially feels like something was taken away from him, you could be looking at a 68 type situation.
Yeah, just if this scenario, convention scenario for Warren is based on her staying in the race, I mean, she's going to stay in the race and get to the delegate threshold in no states, really. I mean, she didn't get to the delegate threshold in New Hampshire, which is supposed to be a strength of hers in a neighboring state. So that just seems would seem to be very discrediting along the way.
I don't know exactly what to think about this because, Liz, it feels to me almost like there are strategic reasons to signal that it's unacceptable for you that there be any nominee other than your preferred nominee and to say, you know, well, we may walk if you don't nominate my guy because you want them to nominate your guy. And that's a strong argument to the party. You know, this is Matt Iglesias' case for Bernie Sanders as the unity candidate because his base is restive. And if you give them what they want, then they're inside the tent pissing out instead of outside the tent pissing in. And that's good for the party. And you know, maybe. But I think also people say a lot of things in contested primaries. The 2008 primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama was nasty. And frankly, I think it is normal for these primaries to be a lot more nasty than this one has been. We'll talk later about advertising in this primary. I've been struck by how little negative advertising there's been in this primary. So I think there's a bit of a fog right now. And if there's a brokered convention, the fog will be even more intense. But political parties have a way of coalescing when they come out of these things, especially when the president is someone like Donald Trump, about whom views are so uniformly negative among voters in the party. I want to ask Liz, though, about what's been happening in Nevada this week, because it's been an interesting example of Bernie trying to coalesce portions of the party that have resistance to specific aspects of his agenda, which is to say the Culinary Union, which is the powerful union representing casino workers in Nevada. They haven't endorsed. They explicitly had a press conference to not endorse anyone, but they've been putting out all these messages about how we will lose our union health plan if Bernie Sanders gets his way about Medicare for All, trying to warn people about that, about Bernie Sanders, and then complaining that Bernie Sanders supporters have sent hostile messages to union officials after they have pointed this out. I've been really struck by the argumentation that we've seen from some people who are on the Sanders side, like Ryan Grimm at The Intercept, basically saying, you know, you don't have to worry about this because he's not going to get a Medicare for All plan through Congress that would actually get rid of the culinary health plan, which I think is true. I just find it weird that this is the week that the argument now is okay to make on the left that, well, actually, Sanders isn't going to have a political revolution. He's not going to get everything that he asked for. So don't worry too much about his agenda. I was wondering what you make of that. Is that messaging that we would hear in a general election about Sanders? How is that going to fly with his base?
Well, I'm not sure if Ryan is actually a Bernie guy. He's definitely a left guy. I associate him more in my head with Warren for some reason. I could be wrong about that. It's not an argument that I would make. I think you have to take Bernie at his word that he fully intends to pass the legislation he says he's going to pass. And I think that, you know, a better approach with the Culinary Union would be to say you would be paying less and taking home more money if we had Medicare for All, if you compare your health plan to what would happen under Medicare for All. And I think that's the argument that some wonks, among them Matthew Brunig, my husband, have been making is, you know, actually do the math here and recognize beyond an emotional attachment to your plan, which I understand people have, especially if they're hard won, as this was and involved a 6-year strike, I understand. You know, but beyond that, there could actually be something even better. And I think that's the pitch to make. And, you know, then again, I seriously doubt that there was a world in which the Culinary Union was ever going to endorse Bernie. I don't think he lost their endorsement. I don't think he was ever really up for it. And I think you can read their decision not to endorse anyone else as a victory for Bernie, frankly. I mean, they didn't come out for Biden or something and try to boost him or drag Bernie down 5 points or something by, you know, endorsing the person directly underneath him, who I think at this point in Nevada might be Buttigieg. They didn't do that either. So, you know, ultimately, not the best outcome Bernie could have hoped for. You would have wished that the Culinary Union endorsed him. But aside from, you know, that, not endorsing anyone else seems to be, you know, the best thing that Bernie could have hoped for here.
Rich, do you see a preview in here at all of conversations we might be having in the general election if Bernie is the nominee? Because this is an idea that's been bubbling under the surface, which has the advantage of being true, that if Bernie wins, very likely he'll have a Republican majority in the Senate. If there's a Democratic majority, it'll be a narrow one where he depends on moderates like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. He's not going to get Medicare for all. He's not going to get a lot of his socialism wish list through Congress. But it feels like a really awkward argument to make, like, don't worry about what the candidate's proposing, because it's not going to happen.
Well, this is why I thought the all along the Elizabeth Warren theory of how you make change was, even though I reject it, is more plausible, which is I'm basically going to do it through the administrative state and unilateral action. And you had Bernie a week or two ago talking about all the executive orders he'd do as well. But prior to that, you know, his idea would have a political revolution and it would remake everything. And that's just not going to happen. And there's just no way Medicare for All is going to pass, even a Democratic Senate, any plausible Democratic Senate, you know, 1-2 Senate seat Senate majority that's dependent on a couple moderates. There's no way they're voting for this. So I think that's part of the moderate case against Bernie would be you can get all the downside of this hugely ambitious agenda that at the very least is easy to caricature. At the same time, when it comes time to govern, if he actually got elected, he wouldn't be able to do any of it. So what's the upside?
Is that selling it short, Liz? Is there a reason to be more optimistic than that, that Bernie would get a lot of a policy agenda through Congress?
I mean, I think that there are possibilities for Bernie. I think that he has thought through them. I think a lot of them have to do with not only executive action he could take, which Bernie is resistant to for reasons that I think are fair, right? That he actually does want, you know, to do things democratically and not unilaterally. But I also think there are things he could do with congressional procedure and so on and so forth. I mean, not to get too in the weeds about it, but I've heard budget reconciliation and so forth kicked about. So, I mean, I think that there are more possibilities than people are perhaps crediting him with at the moment. But what I do think is important is this, and that is Sanders, and this is something that I wanted to say about Sanders supporters as well. I would not presume that Sanders supporters who say they won't vote for anyone but Bernie are being strategic, and the reason is they're not strategic. They have shown, I think, repeatedly, Sanders supporters that they are extremely earnest and very transparent about what they think, to the point of a bluntness that has earned them a reputation for unpleasantness. So I don't think that they're really trying to hide the ball from anyone. I think they're being completely honest when they say they won't vote for anyone but Bernie. And I think that they're very elementally motivated, and I think they're very attached to Sanders. So I would take them at their word there. But I think Sanders is much the same.
Yeah, I mean, this is another analogy with Trump. Trump at least formally right. became a Republican prior to winning the nomination, but wasn't a Republican and brought in a lot of people who, you know, weren't Republican regulars. So when he threatened to, you know, take his ball and go home, there's a plausibility to it that there wasn't with Jeb Bush or something. Exactly the same phenomenon with Bernie Sanders.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the elephant in the room we haven't addressed, which is Michael Bloomberg, who is pushing second place in the national polls. I've been talking with Liz Bruning of The New York Times and Rich Lowry of National Review. We'll be back with Erica Franklin Fowler to talk about the power of political ads and how they've been boosting Mike Bloomberg. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at the New York Times. If you exclude Tom Steyer and Mike Bloomberg, presidential candidates and their outside supporters have spent $383.5 million on television advertising from the 2008 election cycle through this January. And in just this campaign, Steyer and Bloomberg combined have spent $310 million through January and rising rapidly. By the time this campaign is over, Bloomberg will likely have burst through the combined total amount spent on advertising in every previous presidential campaign ever. And so far, it seems to be working. Bloomberg is moving up towards second place in the national polls. The 538 election model gives him a 14% chance of entering the Democratic convention with the most delegates. Now, of course, I've oversimplified somewhat. It's not so simple as that spending tons of money on ads buys you tons of support. Tom Steyer, for one, has gotten much less traction with his own big spending. And Bloomberg benefits from his past national campaign work on guns and climate change. Those efforts have helped him develop links with mayors and other elected officials and activists around the country and have earned him a surprising number of endorsements for a candidate who has bypassed the regular early state process. Still, the ads have been a really big deal, and that's why we have Erica Franklin Fowler with us today. Erica is an associate professor of government at Wesleyan University, where she directs the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks campaign ads and spending in real time. Hi, Erica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us. So are you surprised by how much traction Mike Bloomberg seems to have gotten in the polls with this very ad-heavy campaign strategy?
I can't say that I'm surprised. I mean, we do know from a variety of different places that advertising does move numbers. And given he has the airwaves all to himself and in the sheer quantity that's available, it's not that surprising to me that he has seen his numbers increase.
How durable are the effects of ads like this? I mean, you know, we've seen Tom Steyer have bigger bumps in the national polls than we've seen in Iowa and New Hampshire, where he actually ended up facing a lot of on-the-ground competition. Is there a reason to think that these numbers for Bloomberg might be inflated compared to when we get closer to voting in any given state?
Yeah, I mean, all the evidence suggests that advertising effects are on average small and over time short-lived. So if, you know, advertising decreases or in particular, you know, Bloomberg is benefiting from being up on air in basically a one-sided information environment when he will face competition from other players or other candidates, we should expect the sort of bump that he's receiving to decrease.
Liz, it's not just voters who are watching TV and deciding they're for Bloomberg. He's been getting a lot of this support from elected officials, from mayors, from members of Congress, including a lot of black elected officials. And I think that's been interesting to people given the national focus on stop and frisk and other policies that have caused a lot of concern about Mike Bloomberg in certain parts of the black community. What do you make of the fairly large portion of the Democratic Party institutionally that seems ready to sign on to Bloomberg, who was a Republican not that long ago?
Nothing good. I mean, you know, I understand that two things are going on. Democrats are very concerned about beating Trump. Reasonable. And I agree. The other thing that's going on is they're very concerned about Sanders winning the nomination. Not reasonable. Disagree. So I'm coming from a very different place, I think, than a lot of the Democrats who are coalescing behind Bloomberg. I think that coalescing behind Bloomberg is a real credibility issue, precisely because of stop and frisk, which was an issue that came up this week. And Bloomberg's response to it was this very flippant tweet. Sorry it took me so long to blah, blah, blah. Yeah, sorry it took you so long to realize that was a problem. Wonder why that is. And I think that that the mayoral support for him and the links he's built through his past campaigns and so forth, you know, there's no way to divorce that from his sheer amount of private wealth. He's been able to do this sort of philanthropic advocacy where he pumps money into cities and causes precisely because he has this enormous personal fortune. So, you know, has it been used for good at some points and ill for others? Yes. But it's impossible to divorce the success he has had so far, both in ad buys and through his history of philanthropy, from the fact that he is a billionaire. And it seems galling with Trump in the White House to back someone who is only able to get as far as he is in the polls precisely because he has billions of dollars to spend.
Rich, what do you make of Bloomberg as a general election candidate? I mean, Bloomberg obviously is positioned as a moderate. I can think of a number of issues where you could attack Bloomberg as a left-wing extremist. You would say, you know, his nanny state stuff about trying to ban big sodas and that sort of thing. And obviously his gun control advocacy is a key source of support for him in the Democratic coalition, but would be a key source of opposition among Republican voters. The president is sort of fixated on his height. What do you, is he someone that the president ought to be afraid of here?
I think so, but it would be interesting because it's not a, it's obviously not a Bernie play. It's not a way to win Rust Belt voters in the industrial Midwest back. It'd be a way to double down on Democratic gains in the suburbs. And you know, he has extreme positions on things, but he has a much more moderate profile than Bernie Sanders, and did you know quite a good job here in New York City. But I agree with Liz. You know, I don't agree with her on campaign finance reform. I'm sure I don't think anyone should stop Bloomberg from being able to do this, but there's something really unseemly and gross just by buying your way into a presidential campaign at every level. It's not just the TV advertising, as Liz alludes to. A lot of these mayors govern in cities that have benefited from Bloomberg's largesse one form or another. So I've been very skeptical all along, though I have to admit, you know, the race has broken it in a way that seems to be ideal for Bloomberg. And it's not just national polling. You know, you have some state polling now that's kind of eye-popping. I think it was a Florida poll that had Bloomberg ahead.
By a point, yes.
By a point. So I think it could be a real factor. It's just that the question is, is it ironically a factor that helps Bernie because he's dividing up the center left rather than consolidating it?
Erica, I'm wondering what you make of the messaging in political ads that we've seen so far in this campaign, because I've been struck by how unnegative this campaign as a whole has been. I mean, there have been a few of these skirmishes between the candidates, but they've mostly had pretty unifying themes. They haven't attacked each other as much as I would expect in debates. And my sense is that very little of the paid media advertising has been negative either. We had this one Tom Steyer ad that had fairly mild attacks on Pete Buttigieg for being inexperienced and on Joe Biden for being, you know, sort of like old and around too long. And then Bloomberg has dumped all this money. He's negative on Trump. He's not negative on his opponents, at least yet. So it feels to me like there's a shoe to drop here on what's going to happen when these candidates actually break out the negative messages.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm not sure that the lack of negativity is all that surprising, given the field was still very crowded. Candidates typically, when they go negative, know that there will be a backlash. Citizens in general don't like negativity, regardless of what type of negativity it is. And so I think candidates, you know, no one wants to be the first mover in this space when they're likely to then, you know, take the fall for it. So I think it makes a whole lot of sense that we haven't seen a lot of, you know, internal Democratic attacks and everyone being much more focused on policy. Lots and lots of healthcare messages. You have Bloomberg's obviously Super Bowl ad went after gun violence as an issue in particular. Warren has been going after corruption and those sorts of things. So very, very focused on policy issues and of course on anti Trump, but we wouldn't necessarily in a primary consider that negative because it's obviously aimed at the general, not at the primary phase.
Is that a good thing? I mean, don't negative messages, including negative messages in advertising, don't they help voters figure out what the differences are between candidates? They help them figure out what attacks they might face in a general election and who might be weak in certain places. It kind of feels like voters are almost flying blind if they're not seeing the candidates attack each other.
Yes, for sure. And I think there's a whole lot of political science evidence to suggest that negativity plays a very, very important role in elections for the reasons you suggest, especially when they're policy focused. And that helps, you know, voters understand the differences between candidates and how they move. So I do think that, you know, it's an important phase of the campaign. And I think just the reason we haven't seen more of it is that there are too many candidates yet. As you see the field winnow, I do expect that we will start seeing, I mean, you've already seen sort of in some of the debates, more sharper contrast being you know, drawn between candidates. But I also think it's important for, you know, the general election phase that, you know, the Democratic Party really tease out, you know, who they think is the best candidate. And one of the best ways you can do that is by going negative. There are trade-offs here. We also, one of the other reasons why we haven't seen a lot of negativity is that we don't have a lot of outside groups involved in this primary, because they are the ones that typically would be taking sort of the attack dog role on behalf of a candidate.
Liz, has this campaign been negative enough for you?
I could use a little more. I mean, I think that it's been negative in ways that are toxic, and surprisingly passive in places where a little bit of forthrightness would be a good thing. So I think the negativity you've seen has been sort of passive aggressive, sort of allusions to, specifically Sanders, right? So the Bernie bro narrative that Sanders supporters are especially mean online and especially cruel is back in action. But I think this time Bernie people are sort of not really having it. Anna Kasparian, who's with the Young Turks, pointed out that she has been featured in extremely degrading deepfake porn. Ben Dixon, who's a Bernie-supporting radio host, pointed out that, you know, he receives incredible racial abuse online. I, of course, get called everything you can imagine. Every sort of sexist harassment has come my way. And it's not great, and it's not the way the internet should be. But I don't attribute it to any specific campaign, right? People are very emotional about politics. They have every right to be. And I think the other argument that Bernie people have been making at this point is, look, if other candidates in the Democratic field can't handle getting yelled at on Twitter, then they're not going to be able to face off with Donald Trump. Right. Who is, you know, the premier yeller at of people on Twitter and invites swarms of his Twitter followers. So, I mean, I think the negativity has been toxic in that way because it's very divisive and it alienates, you know, seemingly in a permanent way, especially Sanders' base from the rest of the party. But I do think that the politicians themselves shouldn't be afraid to take a run at each other on policy, which they have kind of demurred on for some reason.
Rich, it's funny. What Liz is describing there is almost meta-negativity. It's the negativity is about whose supporters are too negative. And I'm not saying that, like, people should, you know, make threats or gratuitous insults of people. It's not that this online behavior from supporters of various people is good. I'm just saying that it's, you know, the thing that that has been chosen to go negative about is negativity itself, which, you know, seems – and I think more broadly, we see complaints not just about – toxic online behavior, but basically about, hey, we all have to be in this together against Donald Trump, and it's unproductive for you to attack each other, which I think is just wrongheaded.
Well, at the candidate level, I think Bernie has played it quite shrewdly because, you know, he's taken some hits against the other candidates, Joe Biden especially, on substance, but has been very careful not to get in a personal war with anyone. Probably because he's partly aware that just doing that in a multi-candidate field just rarely helps you. So he's actually, gone out of his way to placate these sort of disputes. You know, there's that op-ed attacking Biden as corrupt that wasn't written by Bernie, you know, or even his campaign that he still apologized for. And I think that's a very shrewd play.
Erica, finally, I want to ask you about some areas of spending other than television advertising, because I think people ask about how effective is TV advertising anymore? Do people still watch ads on TV? And in particular, we've seen Elizabeth Warren's campaign sort of de-emphasize television advertising, spending more on digital, more on organizing. It doesn't look like that has worked for them. Do you have a sense of, you know, is TV advertising less useful than it used to be? Are there other places that campaigns are well advised to spend money, or is TV still king?
TV will still continue to be the lion's share of spending, in part because it's the most expensive place that you can put money. But we should expect, and we are already seeing a lot of spending on digital this cycle. Bloomberg is dominating there too, no surprise. But and then you have Trump and other players following behind him. But I think, you know, like, we just have a lot less evidence, in part because we lacked data on the effectiveness of digital advertising. Obviously, it's a whole different ballgame than you're talking, you know, television reaches, you know, hundreds of people at the same time, or in cases, you know, 100 million of people if you're talking the Super Bowl ads. Whereas digital advertising is very, very different. And I think we don't know enough yet about its effectiveness. In all cases, when we're talking advertising, though, I think, you know, people often oversubscribe effects to advertising when we really all, you know, social science evidence would suggest that advertising, if it I do think that it matters, but when it matters more at the margin than it does, you know, in the sort of size that people ascribe to it. But there are other efforts, you know, canvassing and other things where there is social science evidence to suggest that, you know, deep canvassing may be a particularly effective technique. It's obviously much more expensive than, you know, placing an ad on Facebook or on Google. And so certainly campaigns are going to, television will still continue to take, I think, the line share of the money. But I think campaigns are increasingly looking for multifaceted ways in which to reach citizens because the media environment is fragmented and they have to find citizens where they are.
Are you excited from a social science perspective about the ability to look back on the effects of the Steyer and Bloomberg campaigns here? It seems like I assume you can get a lot of data out of that about how ads affected people.
Oh, for sure. Yes, it's a beautiful little natural experiment for those of us who, you know, the effects of advertising are always notoriously hard to do in the real world because you're usually, there are many, many ways in which people are getting information. And certainly that will still be the case for Bloomberg because he's not solely spending on TV. But the fact that he is up alone in all of these markets where there isn't crowded competition gives you a sort of natural experiment of sorts to exploit to assess effects.
Well, at least this is good for the academics. Erica Franklin Fowler, Associate Professor of Government and Director of the Wesleyan Media Project, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
The Iowa caucuses already feel like a distant memory, but it's worth pausing to consider how utterly insane it is that the first presidential nominating contest routinely has trouble determining a winner in a timely and reliable manner. The Iowa caucuses shouldn't just end. They should be shot into outer space, never be heard from again, and perhaps to serve as a token for higher life forms of our stubborn stupidity and short-sightedness.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
It is Valentine's weekend, and something not many people know is that Saint Valentine is the patron saint of people with epilepsy. I have epilepsy, and, you know, though we've come quite a long way in terms of how people with epilepsy are viewed in society, I still hear the claim that during a seizure, someone can swallow their tongue, and therefore you should put something in their mouth or somehow mess with their mouth during a seizure. Do not ever do this. You can't swallow your tongue. It's attached to your mouth at the bottom, if you haven't noticed. There are some possibilities of asphyxiation. You handle that not by ever putting anything in anyone's mouth, ever, under any conditions, but by gently turning a person onto their side.
For my rant, President Trump has not had a lot of success in getting his favorite people appointed to the Federal Reserve Board. The Republican-controlled Senate more or less ignored his prior proposal to put Herman Cain and Steve Moore on the board. Now he's put up Judy Shelton, who, unlike Moore and Cain, has some relevant academic credentials, but also has a history as a monetary policy crank. She's even advocated returning to the gold standard. She's also had a wild change in her views. She was an ultra hawk who thought the Fed did too much in response to the financial crisis, shouldn't have bought so many assets and tried so hard to prop up financial markets. Now she's an ultra dove. She wants to cut interest rates just like the president does. At a hearing this week, Shelton failed to impress at least three Republican senators, including Pat Toomey, who was alarmed by Shelton's flirtation with the idea that monetary policy should be used as a trade war tool. Toomey and his colleagues should sink the Shelton nomination, as they've done with prior weird Trump picks. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Erica Franklin Fowler. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.